Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1 with It's for Women. The car insurance you can sort online anytime.
Tweet at Miriam O'Cal. Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1.
Well, Marielle Schindler's father, Kurt, died in May 2017. As a child, she grew up with Kurt's stories of life in Austria before, during and after the Nazi era. The son of a prominent Jewish family in the city of Innsbruck, Kurt claimed to have been an eyewitness to events like Kristallnacht. Kurt also claimed family links with many famous people, including writer Franz Kafka, a Jewish doctor who treated Adolf Hitler and his mother, the composer Alma Mahler, and even wartime hero Oskar Schindler. But were his stories true? Well, after Kurt's death, Marielle began sorting through his archive, a process that took her back to Austria and resulted in her new book called The Lost Café Schindler. Marielle Schindler, who's a lawyer by profession, joins me now from her home in London. Good morning, Marielle.
Good morning, Miriam. Thank you very much for inviting me onto your show.
Yeah, fascinating story. Listen, we'll talk about how the events of the 30s and 40s impacted on your family in a moment. But first, tell me a little about Kurt Schindler, your father. What kind of a man was he?
My father was quite extraordinary. He was handsome, tall, persuasive, funny, a brilliant raconteur, and basically had the gift of the gab.
Well, and like many Jewish families, of course, in Central Europe, yours was torn asunder, Marielle, during the Nazi period, lost their civil rights, their homes, their properties, their businesses. In the case of several of your close relatives, their lives in the camps as well. Did Kurt become obsessed with the restitution of the Schindler family's wealth? And if so, why?
I think he grew up in an incredibly privileged, luxurious time. He was the only child of a wealthy entrepreneur in Innsbruck. And I think for all of his adult life after the war, he was trying to regain that glamorous and moneyed time when he had everything, and having lost everything, he wanted it all back, essentially. And his life was very much driven by a desire to reclaim every single penny of every single asset. And our lives, therefore, were marked by that desire for restitution and that thirst for litigation.
And how did you get on with him? I mean, how would you characterize your relationship with your dad?
As a small child and as a girl, I adored my father. Of course I did. He was wonderful. He was the hero in my life. But I think as I grew up, I understood that he lacked a moral compass, and he was rather adrift in his own sea of recrimination and litigation. He trusted no one. He told us that we shouldn't tell anyone that we were Jewish. He told us that we had to understand and understand our history, but we mustn't tell anyone about it.
And you grew up, of course, on his stories and his claims. Did you always have an inkling, especially as a budding lawyer, that your dad might be an unreliable narrator at best, or a fantasist even at worst?
I think as I grew older and became a lawyer, and in fact, probably it was one of the reasons I became a lawyer, to be honest, I understood that he had a very distant relationship with truth and reality. I mean, he sprinkled his stories like all the best raconteurs with sprinklings of truth, but many of them were very far-fetched. And that's what I set out really to discover after he died, as I didn't feel I could rest happily, having had a very difficult relationship with him. I didn't feel I could rest happily until I'd worked out whether any or all of the stories were true.
And you managed, you could conclude some facts. I mean, I gather you've a couple of little things in your home which are evidence of the glamorous Café Schindler that your family ran in Innsbruck and of which your dad was so proud.
Yes, I grew up drinking out of, my sister and I both grew up drinking out of the original cups from the Café Schindler. Now, this was a café I had never been to. It closed in the early 70s, finally, having been through many, many hands. I mean, it was founded by my grandfather on his return from the First World War. And it was an antidote to the horrors of fighting in the mountains. We always think in England and in Ireland about Verdun and the trenches and the mud, but they felt they fought on vertical slopes in snow and on glaciers in the Alps. And he was fighting for the Austro-Hungarian Empire, of course. And he returned to Innsbruck, my grandfather, that is, to found this extraordinary cafe on the main street in Innsbruck. It was a glamorous, triple-fronted cafe where you could not only drink coffee and eat wonderful cake, but you could also dance. It was one of the first places in Western Austria where you heard jazz, for example. There was always a pianist playing classical music in the afternoons, and you could play bridge there and you could play billiards there. So it was the epicenter of Innsbruck, essentially, and it was a magical place. And certainly when I grew up there, when I went to school there in the sort of late 70s, early 80s, when I spoke to the parents of my friends, they would say, "Oh, I used to dance at the Café Schindler. I met my first boyfriend there." So it really was part of the culture and the history of the town.
You were also... And then, of course, go on, Marielle.
And then, of course, the Nazis arrived in 1938. The cafe was stolen from them. It was given to a Nazi crony, and it became then the main Nazi watering hole. It was where everyone went to, you know, drink schnapps and sing Nazi songs. They got it back after the Second World War. They got it back in the 1940s. And very unusually, perhaps, my grandfather returned to Innsbruck and restarted the cafe, almost in the same way as he had done after the First World War. He didn't sadly live very long. He died in 1952, and my father then took over the cafe. He was a disastrous businessman, and he eventually sold the cafe, and then it disappeared. Obviously, it disappeared from the high street in Innsbruck. And it wasn't until I went back to Innsbruck in 2016 that I realised it had been recreated by someone completely unrelated to us, but it is now back on the high street. So this magical place is now back on the high street, not owned by us, but it's still there, which I think is great.
And I know you've been helped in your task of establishing your family story by a pile of photo albums you rescued from your dad's home after his death. And without spoiling the book, which ranges far beyond Kurt's claims, you know, let's look at some of what you discovered through, you know, the help of the album as well. You discovered that you were, in fact, related to the Jewish doctor who treated the Hitlers and survived the Nazi occupation.
Yes, I mean, it's an extraordinary subplot, if you like. My father had been rather proud of the fact that his Jewish great uncle had in 1907 treated Clara Hitler, Adolf Hitler's mother, and indeed the young Adolf Hitler, aged 17. And he treated Adolf Hitler for minor stomach complaints and the sorts of things that adolescent boys suffer from. Clara Hitler had consulted him. She'd been very ill. She had breast cancer. He treated her with incredible devotion and professional compassion. And interestingly, Adolf Hitler was very grateful to Dr. Bloch. And after she died, he wrote several postcards to Dr. Bloch saying how incredibly grateful the Hitler family were to him. These postcards became something of an insurance policy for Dr. Bloch, who, unlike every other Jew in Linz where he lived, he was not rounded up. He was allowed to stay in his house, keep his ration book. He didn't have to put a J on his door, etc. So he eventually left Dr. Bloch with his wife and emigrated to the US. And he was a true figure. I had never really believed this story, but he was in fact an actual figure who did treat Hitler.
One thing you discovered that was untrue, however, I think, Mary, was your dad's claim of being present in Innsbruck on Kristallnacht. Why do you think he told this untruth?
My father was always in trouble. He was in trouble because he needed money to run his vast and complex restitution claims. So he ran up lots and lots of debts. And one way of getting out of those difficulties was to consult a psychiatrist and to claim very bad, very poor mental health. And so one of the things he would do would be to consult a psychiatrist who would then write up an expert's report. And in that expert's report, my father would recount the fact that he, as a 13-year-old boy, was present when his father was beaten up by the Nazis. And this was a very vivid story, because he described how Nazi thugs in November 1938 on Kristallnacht, which was the Reich-wide pogrom, if you like, at the time, how these Nazi thugs had hammered on the door of the flat. They'd come into the flat and they picked up my father's toboggan, which was a classic wooden toboggan with a woven seat, lifted it over, the thug had lifted it over his head and brought it crashing down on Hugo's head. So a very vivid portrayal of someone being beaten up, of his father being beaten up. But what I actually discovered, and this is the rather shocking part of the book in some ways, is that my father wasn't actually there. So I got the witness statements from those who were prosecuted after the war for this act of thuggery. And there was no mention of a 13-year-old boy being present. I then discovered amongst the photo albums a very small, shabby photo album from my father, age 13, as he arrives in the UK. And he's arriving in Dover. He's then going to Buckingham Palace and Regent Street and Piccadilly Circus. He's seeing the sights of the 13-year-old. And it's very clear that the photo album starts in September 1938. In other words, a whole 2 months before Kristallnacht.
Wow.
Yeah.
And of course,
so he was never there.
Delving into your family's past, it was inevitably going to bring to light the pain and the horror of how Jewish people were treated. Your great-grandmother Sophie, your great-uncle Siegfried, your great-aunt Martha all had their lives robbed from in the Holocaust, Martha in Auschwitz. And your relatives, they never received the dignity of an identified burial spot. But am I right in saying that you have decided to bury Kurt's ashes in the Jewish cemetery in Innsbruck? I mean, why is that important for you now to do and for him?
Let's go back to my difficult relationship in a sense. I wasn't there when my father died. We never spoke about where he might want to be buried. So I am making a giant leap of faith in the fact that I believe that he would be peaceful in Innsbruck. It was a place that he loved. He had a conflictual relationship with Innsbruck, but it is also somewhere where he was born, and it's very beautiful there. It's a very, very beautiful graveyard. And perhaps more importantly of all, we have an enormous family grave there full of his ancestors. And I think he would be happy there. He was a man who was very tortured in many ways. And I think perhaps he can get some peace there.
Well, it's a fascinating read, Mariel. Thank you so much for your time this morning. It's called The Lost Café Schindler. It's published by Hodder and Stoughton. Thanks for taking the time to speak to us this morning.
Many thanks, Miriam.
Mind yourself. We'll take a break.